Welcome to the Podcast Maneuver, the officially unofficial podcast for Picard on CBS All Access. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're here today to talk about Season 1, Episode 2, titled Maps and Legends. Aaron, what'd you think?
I think that this episode was saddled with a lot of exposition to kind of establish, because last week they kind of kept it nice and breezy to introduce the characters and the essential mystery. And they lean heavily on nostalgia and Picard's interactions with Dream Data and et cetera. This episode wasn't that smooth, and it had some of like the worst indulgences of Star Trek combined with like the worst indulgences from a CBS crime scene investigation.
Sure.
CSI, NCSI, whatever.
Romulan crime scene investigation.
But that's a lot of that's Star Trek, you know? Like, for every clever scene investigation, like, the one that really sticks out in my mind is where they went to the planet where Geordi and his old crew had been drawn to over time to devolve into this other animal life. And they, you know, like, did this recreation based on the like the footage and found this second shadow and then extrapolated its position. Like, that seemed very cool. This stuff is very much like Batman Arkham City. Mm-hmm. You know, like, press R2 to witness a cutscene to how the hell do we reconstruct this? It's just Romulan molecular forensics.
Yeah, it's like The Division. I think they do that kind of stuff in there. Right. Where it's just like, oh, we can see the residual whatever.
Right. And they have to introduce this like super secret Tal Shiar society of super secret.
Tal Shiar times 10, yeah.
Yeah, they're on double secret Romulan probation. And and then they've got to get, you know, next episode presumably is going to be Picard coming around. It's like, I got a job for us. And Picard, you son of a bitch, I'm in. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's still fun to see Picard going around. It was like super entertaining to see him go back to Starfleet headquarters and have the ensign checking people in, have no idea who he is. To get the visitor when he slaps that visitor name badge on. Uh-huh. And then having like, you know, the fallout from his kind of stepping out on Starfleet. Nobody wants to, he bit the hand and nobody wants to stick it out for him. And I thought they did some pretty good work like revealing some of the players of the, you know, this shadow government they got running in Starfleet. What did you think?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think, I'm really glad I've been watching some Next Generation lately because coming out of this episode was like, man, the writing in this sort of just glosses over a lot of things. It lets you just sort of, they say things that you just have to take at face value, and Picard takes at face value, and I'm thinking, this is pretty weak stuff. And then I go back and I look at season 3 of TNG, and I'm like, ooh, there's a lot of weak shit in there, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of reversing polarity of tachyon beams.
Yeah, and what does that even mean? Yeah. It's magic. It doesn't matter. It's all there to serve the larger, you know, philosophical point that they're trying to make.
Right.
And so I tempered my feelings sort of in the fires of TNG after watching this episode. And I think this feels very Star Trek to me.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have a huge problem with it. I don't know what to say about this show in the era of like prestige television that we're living in. But as a Star Trek fan, this is still doing it for me.
Agreed. Agreed.
And we got to see some pretty cool stuff too, along with like the first scene where we see, maybe we should just get into it.
Yeah.
We see First Contact Day.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a synthetic uprising that destroys the shipyards on Mars. I don't know how much of Mars it destroys. It's implied that it destroys quite a bit of Mars and maybe all of it.
We saw or heard last episode that parts of Mars are still burning because of these exotic materials that they were mining and storing.
Yeah, this is the event that they mentioned, but we get to see it from the inside here.
I think it's just really cool to see like the Utopia Planitia shipyards, which have like, you know, been name checked a lot. Yeah. And every once in a while you'll see like a shipyard, but it's always like a single ship being constructed in like this kind of like scorpion looking dry dock. But here it's like you really get to understand that like this is like a massive scale operation. It's at the heart of the Federation, so it's extremely heavily defended by these badass orbital defense stations. And I also thought it did a pretty good job of kind of like showing how these synthetics are being integrated into Federation society. Like,
Yeah.
You had the singular Data in like this F8. I'm trying to think, it's like, you know, when he picked up Data from his home planet and put him into, you know, he went through Starfleet. I wonder, like, the first couple of weeks of first contact with Data, did they just like store him in a closet? And would he go along with that? He probably would, right? So like all these guys probably are just waiting in their boss, like, you know, hey, plastic people, give me. He's not really hateful, you know, he's not super, but some people some people are phobic of it. Mm-hmm. But I also didn't get the idea that that's what caused F8 to flip out. It does seem like it's the classic Data got possessed by some kind of subspace signal from,
which I'm assuming Romulans at this point, given everything that happens this episode.
And that's the really interesting thing. Like, why would a faction of the Romulan government be invested in letting billions of Romulans die? But I mean, we can see that in our own history, where there's some people that would much rather the world burn than not get their preferential way of society going. And maybe and they're like, the other thing I didn't know is how long the hatred towards synthetic beings and artificial intelligence ran deep, or how deep it ran in Romulan culture.
It's the big question I came away from this episode with, is not, you know, why the attacks on Mars or anything, but why the hatred of synthetics from the Romulans? What is it in their history? Because it goes back before this, right? Like, if you assume, okay, the Romulans were behind the Martian, the destruction of Mars, then you have to assume that they had a good reason in their minds for it. And that hatred of AI goes way back, and I don't understand why.
Yeah, and it's also a little hard for me, because a lot of universes, this isn't a unique sci-fi concept. I mean, this is very Frank Herbert, Dune, you know, this is very Warhammer 40K. Usually in those universes where artificial intelligence have been banned, you have some other form to compensate. Like, you have a human that's given some drug that allows their mind to run 1,000 times faster, but they're no longer fully human. Or
cybernetics.
You do some kind of cybernetic replacements, because it's an unimaginable handicap to not use artificial intelligence in the 24th century, I would think. But yet we know that the Romulans have been one of the Starfleet's most implacable, the Federation's most implacable foes, going back for, you know, a century at least. And the Romulans and Vulcans both have been star-spanning civilizations for at least several centuries before they made first contact with humans. So how did they make that up? Where are the computer analogs in, you know, like, how do they design a starship?
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. It makes me wonder what starship tech looks like now.
Right.
Because I consider what they were doing on the Enterprise to be artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something that can interpret natural human language and can pull up data, can display things, can do things on the ship. It's interacting with humans intelligently. Did that get banned along with the artificial intelligences embodied in androids?
Yeah, like how Luddite is it? Are there like 1,000 Romulans with like slide rules and on drafting boards, like designing warp cores and new disruptor technology?
Something about that? Like, are their computers only do numeric functions?
Right.
I don't know what that means. This might be magical. This might be something scientific. Yeah, essentially. They turn their computers upside down and it says boobs.
Yeah.
That's about it.
The Romulan equivalent of boobs.
Right. So I don't know. I'm super curious to see where they go with the artificial intelligence portion of this.
Would Romulan boobs be pointier and less rounded than their Terran counterparts?
Yes.
Perhaps?
Absolutely.
I would think so. Reminds me of the triangular nipple people of Rick and Morty. Okay. So this F8, I mean, this action scene was horrific. I do like when they show, there's something that is kind of like similar to like the Matrix, where it's like a machine's method of carnage is very precise and yet horrific. Like, he's just taking this mining laser or whatever and just burning their chest cavities straight through, like five of them in a second, and not even thinking about it before he turns the gun on itself.
I didn't see what it was doing to the walls and stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it was punching holes through the entire station.
Could be, yeah.
I have no idea.
Yeah, opening to the vacuum of Mars. Unless Mars has been lightly terraformed, maybe.
It looked like maybe it was. I saw some very bluish-looking areas.
But it's interesting to see this F8, because I saw a lot of similarities to, like, you can see the DNA of, I guess, Data here, because they have very similar eyes. There's also this, like, trying to appear more human, but not getting it quite right.
That smile was definitely not quite right.
But canonically, anytime Data smiled, it was always very, very creepy. Like sometimes that's it's true. Hilarious, like in Data's Day, where like Crusher tells him like when he's dancing to relax, smile, and he turns around, he's just got this horrific Joker Smilex gas rictus on his face. But
yeah,
you can see that like, okay, well maybe if like, you know, some because maybe if some of his workmates take him in and work with him for, I don't know, 7 seasons of television, he might get to something to where Data was. But it's still a little, I couldn't tell if he's primitive compared to Data just because they don't have those kind of stimulations, or if it's just their little B4, they're a little limited.
Yeah, last episode they said that nobody's ever quite replicated the science necessary to recreate Data, so I assume like all that personality stuff is part of that.
Yeah.
They've clearly like modeled F8 physically kind of on Data, in form necessarily, but like skin tone.
Sure. The eyes are almost identical.
Yeah. The eyes are very similar. So like, yeah, they're trying to get to Data tech. They just haven't gotten there yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then we leave the planet Mars and we head over to Earth on Chateau Picard. And Picard learns what the Zat Vash are and that they hate synthetic life for some reason. And these scenes are kind of intercut with him and Laris searching Daj's apartment for clues, and they find out that Soji's calling came from somewhere off world.
Yeah, and there's a whole bunch, like none of this stuff, all this Romulan molecular forensics, it's all total video game stuff, and it's like, I love it. It's where she's like, you know, this is so supernaturally well wiped. The only evidence of it is that it's what, if they follow Zat Vash procedure, they'll leave a real clue wrapped in a fake clue. And Picard literally is like this. It's like, okay.
I mean, just the idea. This is so ingrained in Star Trek. The idea that scientists and I don't know, security analysts, and data analysts could, over the course of years, develop methodologies of disguising their presence and hiding data and wiping things. And in the course of a conversation in 2 minutes, Picard and his sidekick can come up with a solution to find the flaw in their system, right?
Yeah. And they do, like, I guess that this Romulan lady used to be a Tal Shiar operative of some renown, like she's
Zabin's mother
dad
and father
was like a recruiter or a handler for like the agent. So there's these aren't just like, you know, Joe and Jane Romulan. These are like, you know, Jane Bond Romulans and James Bond Romulans. But still a lot of that stuff. And I thought some of it was a little interesting, like where this kind of sounded plausible that like you've got these twin androids and they are below their subconscious level communicating and working together in some way, and there would be the subspace communications, and the Romulan wiping system would get hung up on the fact that they look and sound identical, and there'd be markers for like, oh, we need not human but Romulan review of this material, and that you could kind of go through this like that, okay, and especially since they would think that maybe the Federation wouldn't have a person on the inside that would be able to know. Because obviously, you know, Picard was ignorant of a lot of this Romulan espionage technology like you'd expect him to be. So I think it worked. I mean, there's a couple of things like, you know, Picard just picking up the first thing he said, this like, do you think this could be the clue? Oh, shit, it is. Fuck, what do you know? Maybe cut the commercial break and have him come back with tricorders sweeping it and then find it. Maybe. I don't know. But they got 43 minutes and there's a lot of stuff that needs to happen.
Yeah. All right, we head over to the artifact, as it's called, which we know as the busted up Borg cube, where Soji and Narek are sleeping together. Narek's very open about keeping everything about himself secret.
Yeah.
He's not making any bones that he's trying to keep secrets.
Yeah.
And that should be a red flag, and I think it sort of is for Soji, but not really.
So I'm getting the understanding that this Borg artifact is essentially kind of like an international research where it's controlled for whatever reason by the Romulans, but
might be in their space. Who knows?
It might be in their space, but they're, you know, I saw Andorians, there's Trill, the new person, and This exposition, I thought, went a lot better because it seems, you know, they had a plausible explanation. Like, hey, I've been trying to get here for months and it's my first day on the job. And, you know, Soji's kind of like taking her under her android wing and explaining all this stuff to it. I thought it was really fast how Soji and Narek are just literally, they met and then the first time we see them, they're fucking.
Yeah, they had coffee. He explained his sad story and yeah, they're in bed.
Yeah, yeah. But he's very attractive and so is she. So it's like, you know, you got a bunch of co-eds on this Borg cube and everything's kind of dangerous. And
yeah, I mean, that's pretty believable. The yeah, less believable thing is that she might go back and do this again if
yeah,
she knows he's keeping all these secrets.
And right. But I'm just very curious about like what Soji, because they later they'll allude to a nest of these synthetics, like yeah, that these 2 or 3 years ago they got embedded at different parts in the galaxy and they're all working towards some common purpose. But it seems like there's a lot more than just two of them. Mm-hmm. But all this stuff is happening outside of their conscious control. So I'm curious to see like what it looks like when Soji gets activated. Mm-hmm. And what the hell are they actually doing there in the examining this Borg cube?
You mentioned the nostalgia that this show is trading in the first episode.
Yeah,
there's some sort of manufactured nostalgia in this next scene.
Uh-huh.
Between Picard and this Moritz Benayoun,
right?
His doctor, who tells him he could have a fatal brain syndrome, and Picard asks him, "Hey, certified me for duty anyway because I need a ship." And the doctor agrees, I think.
Can they really not get Gates McFadden?
Yeah, this is a doctor that was supposedly serving with him on the Stargazer.
Yeah, I think he's like the chief medical officer on the Stargazer is what I understood.
Yeah, I understand that we've seen the Stargazer at least once in TNG.
Sure, it's established.
But I don't recognize this guy.
I mean, I wouldn't surprise me if this name was mentioned, like if Picard made an offhand reference, but
yeah,
still, I guess... The thesis is he doesn't want to involve his old crew from the Enterprise because he knows that they would literally do anything for them. And this is probably right, going to be bad potentially for their careers. I mean, it's essentially a Star Trek 3, Star Trek 4, where like Kirk's going like, hey, it's exactly like that, because Kirk was going to these people and like, hey, we're doing this for Spock because mm-hmm, Spock sacrificed himself for all of us. And I think there's still a fragment of him out there. So you're putting all of your careers on the line, but I want, so maybe they didn't want to do that, but I don't, some of Picard's rhetoric about like, well, I don't want to put like Worf and Geordi and Riker in jeopardy is kind of like rings hollow. Like, cause I'd really like to see that.
Of course, everyone would.
But they probably can't get everybody to commit, and they couldn't make the money yeah, work, and Michael Dorn doesn't want to put the turtle shell on his forehead anymore. Uh-huh. So we've got all this kind of half-ass excuses about why Picard just can't get the gang back together again for one last crusade.
It might be that in a scene that's already dancing around the topic of Iremotic syndrome, they don't really want to bring Gates McFadden right, back.
They didn't actually mention.
That's a little too best or all good things.
Yeah. And they stop just short of saying
they do
the condition, but they hint that it's like it could be any of a half dozen things, but all of them are bad.
Yeah.
So we asked last week if that was going to be an issue going forward. Absolutely, it's going to be an issue going
Seems
forward.
Seems like it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Or at least the threat of it.
And then we go to Starfleet with Picard, where he asks an admiral to temporarily reinstate him for a single mission. Unfortunately, Starfleet heard his interview from the last episode and they're pissed. Picard warns the admiral that they're in danger, but she doesn't believe him and she denies his request and tells him to go home.
Yeah, I guess we're going to keep right on shirking our duties here, Jean-Luc.
Mm-hmm.
First fuck of Star Trek history. The admiral said,
I didn't even notice it.
I saw so many
people talking about how this episode had a fuck in it, and I was like, are you talking about Narek and Soji? Because I didn't catch it.
Yeah, no, she dropped the sheer fucking hubris. Which I thought it was great. I like how Picard took this tack of like, you know, considering all the times I've personally saved Earth and the entire Federation, the highly documented series. Mm-hmm. I want to be reinstated for one mission. Give me a small warp capable espionage vehicle. And if you think it's too much, too high profile thing for an admiral, I guess you can demote me. And she just comes back with this sheer fucking hubris of you. Like last mm-hmm. week you were kicking us in the balls and now you want a favor because, And also, like, him...
She's absolutely right.
Yeah, and she, when he says, like, I've been trying to keep out of it, and then his first statement is essentially, I suspect a cybernetic conspiracy that goes all the way to the top of the Romulan, and she's like... Oh, so you're actually in all of it. There's no part of it that you're not in. All that stuff was pretty good, and I really liked this out. I wish there was a personal relationship here with the Admiral. And I think you're supposed to understand that they probably do. Like, he probably has a good working relationship. Well, I don't know if it's good anymore. But he's had a working relationship with probably all the brass of Starfleet. Yeah. He'd have to with his position. But it was cute. Like I said, I thought maybe it stretches credibility that this young ensign standing underneath the schematic of the, you know, Enterprise D wouldn't recognize Jean-Luc Picard, who was just on the Federation news lambasting the organization, but maybe he does. And he was just giving him shit about it.
He was ordered to give him the cold shoulder.
It's like,
if he ever
look
came
at
in.
This fucker. He's a Romulan lover, blah, blah.
Yeah, I love the flip-flop here between the nostalgia and the sheer hubris, right? Because, like, you've got the scene where he teleports in and he looks at Starfleet HQ, and he goes inside, he sees the old ship, and we're all thinking, oh, it's the return home. He is home, right?
Sure.
Starfleet is Picard's home.
Sure.
And then he gets told to go home by Starfleet. Yeah. It's really good.
It feels like the star quarterback from a college team from 20 years ago going back to campus, and he's expecting that, like, oh, everybody's going to think, but no one even knows who the hell he is.
Yeah, it's that fucking episode of Always Sunny where, what is it, where they start the drinking game. They go do all the pubs, and I think it's Frank and Dennis go back to his old fraternity.
Right.
And he's like, I used to run this school.
Yeah.
And they're just shitting all over him.
Yeah. I like that. But there's the things like his mental condition, because he played this at the end. Like, he just ends it with a naked threat to the Admiral. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, after she's already said, you know, fuck you and the high horse you beamed in on, he pulls the, like, you ignore me again at your own peril. And she's just like completely over it. I actually liked how she circled back around, even though she has every reason to, like, hate and dislike and mistrust this person. Picard, still, his opinion carries enough weight that she's going to go and do some homework.
Yeah.
Like, well, shit, you know, if there is something to look into, maybe I should look into it, because he is, after all, Jean-Luc Picard.
And there definitely is something to look into.
Yes.
It's just the person she's asking is the person she needs to look into.
Yeah, they've already captured the director of the Central Starfleet Intelligence Operation. Yeah. So what are you gonna do?
Okay. I got to talk tech for a second.
Okay.
Teleporter thresholds, I'm going to call them.
Uh-huh.
Like these doorways that sort of teleport you back and forth.
Uh-huh.
How do they stop people from getting telefragged? Because there are several doorways where people walk both in and out.
There's got to be some kind of, like, timing circuitry that's like, well, if there's some kind of matter in the hoop, then it stops the hoop from working. But
it still picks up the pattern buffer and then puts them in. Because nobody stops. Nobody, like, waits for a green light or anything.
Yeah, you're
right.
They
just walk straight into it.
It must
assume.
Just be, like, traffic controlled based on, I don't know. Like, what if a butterfly flaps in there at the same time?
Right, the fly. Suddenly Picard comes out the other side and he's got a fly head.
He's got these magnificent velvety wings. And
yeah.
I honestly don't know. You're not supposed to think too hard about it.
God damn, I want to.
Yeah, I know.
I want to because it's a cool idea. It's just... Mm-hmm. I want to know the tech behind it. So then we go back to the artifact where Soji meets a new recruit as they're being, as they begin their workday in what they call the gray zone, which seems like it's an area of the Borg cube that is, as of yet,
still
sort of
Borg-y.
Unsecured. Yeah, you could, the possibility of being assimilated maybe when you
Did
go
you
in
see
there.
That some of the people working on the Borg cube looked like they were former Borg themselves?
Oh, were they?
Yeah, like some of the, so there's a person like in overalls, but I don't know if they're like people at this stage. But he was doing some kind of job, and they had like discolored skin grafts over like, you know, the ocular implants of the Borg.
Like,
and you see
Data
them being,
did with his skin of first contact.
Exactly, and you see that like the person undergoing the Borgification surgery. So it's like, but they talk like this thing that Soji's doing is some kind of like pie in the sky. You know, resurrection reclamation project. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, so are these Borg not all they've removed the Kind of like, I guess, Seven of Nine was. Like, they got her and they removed all of her shit, or all the stuff that they could, but she was still very much a Borg drone and yeah. kind of gradually lost her connection to it. But I don't... The other thing is, like, I bailed out at on Voyager about when Seven of Nine showed up.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there's tons of Borg lore that I'm not... Because, like... What I remember the Borg is, as soon as a Borg cube gets compromised from a collective standpoint, they blow it up. Mm-hmm. So it's like the Borg detected something happened on this. The Borg severed the contact, but they didn't blow up. Instead, yeah. they were all placed in some kind of weird stasis. And now they're, you know, but like it is a menacing thing, because what if the collective does decide to reestablish contact or... Mm-hmm. You know, and we've also in Next Generation, you know, Lore was leading like this Borg faction of Borg separatists. Like Borg disconnected from the continuum can still be dangerous.
Well, they seem to have done a lot of research already.
Yeah.
This is, I think it's called Borg Artifact Research Institute.
Right.
Which kind of trains the new recruits and stuff. And like he, you know, mentioned some very specific details about why it's disconnected and how it becomes disconnected mm-hmm. When something particular goes offline. That's the moment. So they know a lot about it.
Yeah. And they have these tags they wear. They're like, remind me, like dosimeters you wear at a nuclear facility. And it's uh-huh. like, if this thing starts flashing green, it means the collective have reestablished contact. You need to run.
Yeah. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And I had this sign that says this facility has gone 5,843 days without an assimilation.
I saw that.
That was pretty cute. So it's yeah. been it's one of those things where it's like, a dangerous situation, but it's a stable dangerous situation that like people like Soji are already kind of dismissing the routine safety concerns, and she's all about getting, you know, rehabilitating the XBs is what they call the ex-Borg people apparently.
Yeah. Then we go back to Chateau Picard, where Dr. Girardi's visiting at Picard's request to give him some information she has on Maddox, and also she has some information on Dodge as well. She says that Dodge's identity was probably constructed 3 years ago, possibly by Maddox, but she's not sure why. And then Girardi asks the obvious question about this other twin that Picard has already wondered, where is she and what is mm-hmm. she after?
Yeah, it looks like they're the two daughters were being placed in highly respected and influential places where they're doing artificial intelligence or cybernetic research. Mm-hmm. The Daystorm Institute versus the Borg Artifact, you know, Science Center or whatever you called it. Research Institute.
I know you didn't care for her in that first episode, but I really hope Dr. Girardi ends up on the ship that Picard hopefully gets.
She's got to.
Yeah.
Because otherwise they've established multiple characters that they're just going to discard before the end of the season.
She says she wishes she could have met Dodge and like,
yeah.
Well, you can meet Soji. Like,
sure.
I really want her on board. Yeah. I like her.
What did you think about, on a scale from cute to too cute, Picard disowning science fiction?
It's fine. Picard yeah. has never struck me as a sci-fi guy.
Yeah.
He's about history. He's about
Shakespeare.
Ships and Shakespeare.
Philosophy. And, he doesn't have yeah. time for this science fiction shit.
Absolutely.
Plus, what would science fiction even look like in the 24th century?
I mean, it would exist, I'm sure.
It'd be probably post-singularity type stuff, because they already yeah. have like all the things, 99% of what we think of as of modern science, you know, galaxy-spanning civilizations and unimaginably mm-hmm. powerful weapons and terraforming and faster-than-light travel, matter replication. They got it. They got it all.
There'd probably be a lot of time travel stuff, a lot of dimensional stuff.
Or like mystical things. Like there's like Harry uh-huh. Potter type science fiction going on.
Why? What does that even mean? I'm not...
Well, it's just like does Federation, which is seems like it's a secular institution... but does also respect local religions and customs? Like, is there mm-hmm. a fascination with mysticism? Like, is that the science fiction technology? Like, all their technology that, as Asimov would say, is indistinguishable from magic because it's so advanced, mm-hmm. is like real magic? Back in fashion, I don't know.
Yeah,
because it's never really left our fashion. So
true. She also drinks Earl Grey tea, and she's reading that The Complete Robot by Isaac Asimov. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's a little cute in here, but honestly, I'm okay with it. Then we head back to the artifact, where Soji helps to disassemble several Borg, but she displays a lot of empathy for them, and I wrote down, Narek will remember that.
Mm. Yeah, they're like the Romulan surgeon who's removing these or calling the... I didn't understand the problem because she's not... these people are nameless, and a lot of the people, they don't even know what species they're from because they're from another quadrant in the galaxy that we haven't explored. We as, you know, Starfleet. I consider myself a member of Starfleet.
Yeah.
That we haven't explored yet, so like we have no idea what these species are, what planet they're from. They're mm-hmm. just like these individuals that have been in stasis for 14 years, and they're one by one de-Borgifying them. So I didn't understand what Soji's objection to calling them nameless is. Like, should you christen them Tommy?
I mean, look at Voyager, right? You just assigned a number to a species.
Sure. Seven of Nine is still called Seven of Nine as her personal name. Like,
right.
Well, it's all arbitrary. Like, we could ask the Borg, because the Borg don't seem like they have an opinion on it as of yet. But mm-hmm. a lot of body horror there, too. Like, that removing of the ocular implants and stuff, pretty grisly shit.
It was.
Yeah.
I was wondering in this scene about Soji and her sort of empathy for the Borg here. Like, is this intentionally programmed into her personality, or is this some kind of emergent quality from being around the Borg, doing what she does?
Or she's subconsciously aware of her own makeup and...
Right, right. Yeah. How much of her is activated at this point?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure we have an answer yet.
Nope.
So we go back to Chateau Picard, where Jean-Luc pulls his communicator out of storage and contacts someone named Raffi for a ship. Not much to say on that one, so let's mm-mm. keep moving. Admiral Clancy contacts...
But that's a moment. Like, him slapping the communicator on his chest and just coming from the visitor, like, you know, the tin badge he was wearing before. Like mm-hmm. It's played as a moment, him slapping that thing back on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, like... That's one of the updated ones. That's not the style of communicator in TNG. Yeah. It's after first contact stuff.
Yeah, it might have been like in Nemesis era because it had like squared corners. I'd have to go back and look.
I think it was Generations that introduced that one.
Did they? Okay.
Maybe. Yeah, the movies, I think, for TNG did that. So then we go to Admiral Clancy contacting Commodore O, presumably an intelligence officer of some kind. They don't really say mm-hmm. who she is, but Starfleet intelligence. To ask if there's any validity to Picard's claim of Romulan activity on Earth. The Commodore tells her, no, I don't think so. That sounds stupid.
I notice on her desk, so she looks like a Vulcan. She could be a Romulan because they kind of look, mm-hmm. the only thing that distinguishes them is the Romulans still are a passionate people, whereas
the shoulder
Vulcans...
pads. That's what distinguishes them.
But I noticed that she has one of those infinite diversity, infinite combinations logos on her desk, which has kind of like been adopted as the flag or heraldry for Vulcans. So you're supposed to understand.
I don't recognize it.
Yeah, if I point it out, I'm sure it's like this triangular motif with us like pointing into the center of a circle. And it's something that like in the third season of Star Trek, Spock just ostentatiously mentioned as something that was valuable to Vulcans because they were trying to sell Vulcan merch. But it's since then been kind of like, you know, put as like an important piece of kind of like the same way that the Federation planets is kind of like a galactic map with the, you know, the holly surround the laurel surrounding it like mm-hmm. that. This is like the symbol for Vulcan. So you're supposed to understand that she's a Vulcan. But is she a Vulcan? Because we're later going to find out in Ensign Rizzo that looks human, but has had her ears rounded off.
Mm-hmm.
I would think it would be harder to hide a person like that, but I've personally seen Riker running around on a planet with shit on his forehead, and he's supposed to and mittens.
Yeah,
his alien disguise was shit glued on his face, and he wore mittens.
Right, but usually that's in primitive civilizations.
True.
Here we're talking about the Federation.
They're getting beamed.
You could
all the time.
Right. You cannot recognize mm-hmm. Don't we have a Neo in the crowd who can recognize a pattern buffer or a Link or a tank or something?
Yeah, and like, and McCoy is always bitching in the old series about this damn Vulcan physio. Like,
right.
There's got to be
different.
At least a pattern buffer. Like, are you the species you say they are? Like, that's like, you know, I don't know.
You would think so.
Sometimes you I notice Star Trek likes to stop. Forget about the 24th century and just like, well, mm-hmm. yeah, it worked in the 21st century like this, so whatever, you know.
Yeah, absolutely they do.
But you're supposed to just kind of roll with that. But I wonder if she's an actual Vulcan. Is she a Vulcan that's sympathetic with whatever this, you know, Super Tal Shiar is doing? Because, why would... what did the Romulans do to turn the head of the Starfleet intelligence apparatus against Starfleet? And how long has she been working for them?
Yeah, I mean, they're clearly undercover. How long has that been the case? I don't know. I'm assuming that they are Zat Vash. Like, I think this is our introduction to the Zat Vash organization.
Hmm. Well, yes, clearly the like Lieutenant Rizzo and Nadir.
Oh.
The Romulan guy, the brother and sister. We found out they're brother and sister. They're the, what'd you call it? It's not the Tal Shiar, it's the
Zat Vash.
Zat Vash. But they mentioned that like Commodore Ro or Commodore O is like one of their more valuable recruits. So I think,
oh, okay,
she's working with them, but I think she was like at some point true blue for the Federation.
Okay.
But you also wonder, you know, because like they mention in the conversation with Admiral Clancy that she's like, you know, when we decided to cut the Romulans loose, we had 14 influential species saying that it was like either Romulans or us. Mm-hmm. It's easy to see that maybe there are parts in the upper echelons of the Federation. It's like, hey, we can either sit here and quote unquote do the right thing and watch the Federation get torn apart, or we can, like, I don't know, start a synthetic revolution on Mars and destroy a bunch of ships so you no longer have the capability anyway, and then, like manufacture a way for the Federation to shirk their duty with honor, or at least plausible, like, hey, what are we to do? You know, our hands were tied. I'm wondering if they're going towards that kind of high-level political machination.
Yeah, that's really not Picard's Starfleet anymore.
Yeah.
If that's
oh no.
The case.
Yeah. But I did. So there was some criticism. Did you see the Red Letter Media discussion of Picard?
No.
I was a little disappointed. I liked the Red Letter Media guys. They were pretty influential. You know, when they started doing their thing, as far as like having me thinking about popular media in a more thoughtful way. But I don't know about, because like their take was, I don't like that the Federation has been reduced to this racist, xenophobic institution. I don't think that Starfleet is racist or xenophobic necessarily. I mean, in like the camera crew running around Picard, there's like six different alien species, and it's clearly Federation is still a huge tent. It's more like fuck the Romulans in particular because they're like an old, bitter enemy.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you can construe It's kind of like, I don't think you can construe the abandonment of the Romulans to their fate to like, oh, the Federation just hates aliens now. This isn't like the fucking...
No, they make it clear in this episode it's political pressure from 14 other races.
Yeah, this isn't the Galactic Empire where Palpatine just hates other races for some reason. So like, yeah. I think we should, it's good to push back on that this isn't... From it'd be very easy for Picard to look crazy when he's like, oh, this isn't my Starfleet, and they're like, what are you talking about? It's just the Romulans. We've been at war with them for a century.
Yeah, they've been instigators,
and we were trying in the middle of trying to save them. The robots went crazy, and half our fleet got destroyed. And what are we like? It's got to be the political. I think the political situation in the Starfleet at the turn of the 25th century is a lot smart. It's one of the smarter things that they've done at the show. It feels plausible to me. Mm-hmm. Plus, there's tons of stories in Star Trek about like different factions within the Federation going rogue. Like, what was the one Section 31 or whatever?
Oh yeah, right.
That was like literally like this black ops of Federation. Uh-huh.
I mean, a lot of admirals and Federation muckety mucks were taken over by some aliens.
Right.
And turned out to be sleeper agents. Like,
right.
There was a lot of shit like that.
No, I mean, as much as I would love to see a reconstituted next generation of old ass Picard warping around and giving lectures to societies trying to keep children in border wall cages and going to the trans people planet and seeing what they're all about. And
what's the thing about the Federation? It's always struck me as a very tenuous thing anyway, because of the different philosophies of all of the races and species under its, you know, purview. It's like, how do you keep together an organization of people who have extremely differing opinions on everything?
Well, the one thing that helps is they get to choose the time and manner of first contact. So it's like they don't go to, you know, in fact, that's one of the things they consider is like, how willing is this culture to embrace something like the Federation? And
it's true.
Yeah. So it probably helps that they can kind of pick and choose who they make contact with and when, and the timing of that is probably
advantageous. Yeah, but then the evolution of societies has to be something to consider, you know?
Yeah, like, hey, they haven't gone through their 21st century eugenics war where they just have to hate everybody and kill. They need to get sick of war before we go
talking about even evolution after the fact. Like, you invite somebody into the Federation.
Right.
Those societies are going to evolve in different directions, potentially. Yeah. How do you hold that all together?
That's a great question.
I think we're seeing some of the fallout from that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of tit for tat policies. Like, you know, part of it is just like any other, like, you got to keep the Andorans happy because they are the leading supplier of the lithium, and boy, if you piss them off, then your ships are going to run out of warp drive. And yeah, there's a lot of galactic politics going on here.
Same power dynamics that we experience.
Exactly.
Okay, go back to Chateau Picard. Loras is set up at, upset at Jean-Luc for wanting to go on this mission. He says he has no choice. It's just, you know, it's important not just to him, but many, many people. She tells him to go on the mission and take Zaban so they can die together. Mm-hmm. And then Jean-Luc says he's already made the call to find a new crew. And this is the scene where, you know, he says he can't call, you know, Riker, Worf, LaForge, any of those.
Got to find someone that hates you but has nothing to lose. Because that's the thing. It's like, you know, if someone hates you and has nothing to lose, that doesn't mean you're going to get them to go on your damn fool idealistic crusade. No. Like, they got to have something to gain, too. You have to, and it seems like maybe with this person that he's there to talk to,
Rafi,
maybe it's a hatred for Romulans. Mm-hmm. Because that seems to be the thing that calms her down. That and the Chateau
Picard.
And a
love
Picard.
Of wine. Yeah. Yeah. His love particular
wine,
vintage.
Love of wine.
86.
Hate the knife ears. And that's going to get the job done.
Yeah. So we move on to Commodore O berating Lieutenant Rizzo for bungling the capture of Dodge and reminding her that they have only one more opportunity to interrogate a synthetic and everything is at stake. They use this term everything and all and like... They're really trying to impress upon you the stakes to all of this, and I don't know why, because I don't know what their goal is, but very important to them.
There's two of them, but they also refer to a nest, so there's not just two of them, but maybe there's two of them that are actually out working around, and they got
to
track
down the
others.
Well, they have one more shot at finding the nest,
maybe,
right?
Because
may be their last lead.
Yeah.
And yeah, they could dead end on him.
I liked how there's like Commodore O was like busting her over the sloppiness of the stuff that we saw that Picard and the Romulan Laris was like the fact that they didn't take out the reflected blaster fire from this like shiny brass banister.
Yeah,
you know, they're trying to move very fast and they're breaking things and they don't get it quite. You know, up to professional snuff. And maybe we're supposed to get the idea that this Lieutenant Rizzo is a little brash and sloppy. They intimate that she's the one that led the strike team that caused all this, that bungled
it
in the first place.
I think this is a very confusing scene when not paired with the final scene.
Okay.
Because I rewound and rewound and rewound and listened to this thing over and over again to try and determine, okay, are they Zadvash? Are they Romulans? Are they undercover agents? Or are they part of Starfleet working on an undercover operation to collect Dodge and find out where the nest is? Like, I was just trying to put all the pieces together, and I eventually got it. And then I watched the last scene. I was like, oh, well, fuck. I should have just waited 5 minutes, and I would have known it all.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. The next scene is Jean-Luc going to see Rafi, who is initially hostile, until he tells her that the Romulans are, you know, they're secret Romulan assassins operating on Earth.
How much does it take a how much does it cost to take a shuttle taxi out to the desert?
Nothing, I assume.
Oh yeah, you're
Federation
right.
Federation society.
You're right. It's just like they've got these like giant shuttlecraft thing marked taxi. It's just like I was just thinking like, what would the cost? I mean, clearly it's probably free because there's no money in the Federation, but like,
yeah,
still, why not just beam out there?
She might not. Yeah, I don't know why you couldn't beam out there. To get back would be harder, I would think.
Yeah, and then also like it kind of blew my mind that Picard was able to beam into the Dodge's quarters, her private personal quarters that. And I was like, well, yeah. I guess it wouldn't be under police. It wouldn't be like roped off for police because the story is that Dodge never existed and there was nothing, anything that happened in this apartment. So maybe it's just an empty building. And I don't know.
Yeah. Wonder if how you, you rope something
if the Federation's, there's no money, you just walk by and there's an empty apartment you like, you just go in and like claim it.
Yeah, let's not get too deep down that rabbit hole.
Let's not.
The economics of the Federation.
Let's not. It's not going to do anyone any damn good.
It won't. So we get to the final scene, the artifact, where Rizzo checks in on Narek to make sure the operation's on track and deliver a warning. She asks if he's learned the location of the nest of the synthetics or anything at all, really. And she makes it very clear that she's on her way there, and if no progress has been made when she arrives, she's going to implement her own approach.
Nope. So Lieutenant Rizzo is a Romulan who's the sister, older sister of Narek.
Yes.
And she's letting him do the seduction game because he thinks that's the fastest way to get the information out of Sophie. Soji.
Soji.
And she's skeptical, but she's already fucked up her half of the... It's funny her coming in and rolling tough on him because it's like the ultimate answer is like, well... The only reason I'm in this position and I'm under a lot of stress and pressure is because you fucked up your operation. Mm-hmm. You know, if you had done yours, like, you know, right, then I wouldn't be in this position. So, I don't know. She also threatens him and says that your survival is the most important to me of anyone except for my own. Mm-hmm. So, she's going to be willing to cut him loose if he doesn't make progress. I wonder if that'll change his approach dealing with Soji at all. Is he going to start playing good Romulan,
put more pressure on
hot Romulan, bad Romulan with her?
Yeah, I mean, he's on a timer here.
Because it's like, the other thing is like these Zatbot people or what Zaphod Beeblethroxes is that they were talking a lot of mess when they were trying to round up Dodge about like, has she activated yet? Is she activated?
Yeah.
That must be... So there must be a something that they're waiting, and once they activate, it'll be too late, but they must not know the exact date or time that they activate because it's something they're talking about and speculating and worrying about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I still want to know, you know, the answer to the big question I have is, why do the Romulans hate AI so much, and why are they... Well, I know why they're looking for this nest, but the core of that is, why do they hate AI? And I hope we get at that question, and it's not just left as, well, the Romulans hate AI.
Yeah. No, it has to be some kind of, like, in science fiction, there's usually some kind of massive war where the artificial intelligence almost wipes out the organics, and then the organics swear, never again
we're not privy to that, and no one's mentioned it. It's like,
right.
Well, if the Romulans were almost wiped out by their own civilization's AI, wouldn't everyone know about that?
But they're secretive that...
I get that it's secret, but, like...
Yeah, you know, it beggars the imagination that,
like, Zabin, like the Vulcans, or Laris didn't know? Wouldn't mention the
fact.
Did
this happen after the Vulcans and Romulans split as a society?
Right.
Did the Vulcans not know? Are there no spies in the Romulans? I mean, we've seen spies. I mean, shit, yeah. I've seen Counselor Troi dress up as a Romulan and spy. Like, none of this has ever been uncovered before?
No, and Laris and Zabin would almost certainly know what happened. Because it had to have happened before the Martian attack.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm super curious what.
But a lot of the stuff is also based in like, you know, Cold War era spying, where like there was shocking things that we did not know about the Russians, that just because like there's cultural blind spots, you know, like you try as you might want to think about the enemy, but you're still approaching their plans and their technology from your perspective, and a lot of times that allows you to. Like, I just saw something today where for the longest time in the Cold War, the Soviets thought there was something very special about the building in the middle of the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. Like, this must be some kind of super secret, like, hardened communication center, because, like, all these top brass, they go in there and they're going in and out every day. It was the hot dog stand.
Okay.
So everybody goes at the same, you know, and they go get their hot dogs. That the Soviets couldn't even conceive of that, so they thought that this is something. So like it happens, and maybe it doesn't make sense in the 24th century because of all the stealth technology and stuff that they've got. But weird shit happens, and since it does in our life, then they extrapolate it to happen in Star Trek life too.
Well, they have to do something in this show, in my opinion, to humanize the Romulans. They've got to let us know why the Romulans are doing what they're doing, make them at least somewhat sympathetic, because I really dislike, most of the time, I really dislike a very opaque villain.
Yeah.
I want to know why the villain is doing the things they're doing and what motivates them.
Don't want another Game of Thrones situation where it's like, no. Oh, it's going to be good. And then you never, but yeah, because it's also, it's a huge mystery because it's something that the Romulans are willing to almost die as a civilization to protect. Mm-hmm. Like whatever that they are trying to head off must, from their perspective, be a rational, attractive, like the 95% of them dying and their homeworld being destroyed is a preferable alternative to whatever they were trying to sabotage and prevent.
Right.
That's insane. Like, what in the hell could that possibly be?
It's an us or them kind of mentality, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There must be something just sheer. And they do lean into that. Like, Picard's Romulan friend mentions that it's a fear and a dread and a phobia, like
it's
a terror.
Built in, but why is it built in?
Exactly.
That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
I hope we get there. I have one more piece of tech talk.
Okay.
Long distance, zero delay, holographic communication.
Subspace communication, baby.
Is it possible? Because I've seen Starfleet communicate with the Enterprise when it's been out near the neutral zone, like on the edge of the neutral zone. In like season 3, which is the season I've been watching of TNG, there's a 2-hour delay on that communication. Mm. How is there no delay? Because there's no way that this cube is within Federation limits, right?
Yeah, I think it's to do with, like, they have this concept of subspace station relays where they essentially relay the communication packets faster than light.
Why wouldn't Picard use that when he's on a timer and needs there to not be a 2-hour
delay? Because
if
it's at the Romulan neutral zone, they're not allowed to have those, like, communication stations there. But you'd think they'd be... Yeah, I mean...
I don't know.
Apparently, after
the
Romulans got destroyed, maybe the Federation went in there and put some subspace relays as a humanitarian, and now they're piggybacking on the shadow of the phase relay when they flip the Benzang rings and realign the polarity.
Yeah. Was there a deflector dish anywhere around? Was there a deflector dish anywhere nearby?
I'm sure
they can make that happen.
Yeah, you throw a wrench in space, and you're going to hit 3 deflector dishes, right. Of course.
And they just attenuated the deflector dish differently.
Course,
it was fine. Okay.
They flushed out the Passard ramjet scoops with elemental hydrogen and...
Oh, they sent the communications back in time. That's how you do it.
There you go. They slingshot the communication around the sun.
Yep.
Had the whales pass it along their singing network, and Bob's your uncle, real-time holographic teleportation.
Perfect. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the 4 pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Okay, that's about all I got for this episode.
We got some feedback. Would you like to consider it?
Yeah, let's do it.
If you'd like to send feedback, you can do so by a humpback whale telegram sent to picard@baldmove.com. First up, Joshua. You guys had some questions, so I want to clarify the timelines to my understanding. The year 2379, 20 years before now, is when Nemesis took place, the events of Star Trek Nemesis, the last TNG era movie.
Okay.
Between these dates, they knew about the Romulan sun failing and put together this large rescue fleet. The fleet was being built on Mars at Utopia Planitia. Picard left the Enterprise to command this rescue fleet. Then the Synths destroyed the fleet and essentially most of everything else on Mars, and the Federation turned their back on their promise.
And that was 14 years ago.
That's 14 years ago. And the year 2387, the Romulus sun went supernova, destroying the Romulans. So this is 8 years after Nemesis. Around this time, Picard essentially retired in protest during due to the lack of relief effort. And the year 2399 is when Picard takes place. One of the things I love about Star Trek is the open canvas the setting can be for modern day issues. Star Trek as a place. I heard one Star Trek podcast describe it this way. For Picard, I'm seeing Brexit, Syrian, or any refugees, nationalism, and isolationism playing a part in this season. Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, like, a lot has been made recently of how America and our allies have architected this giant global system of interdependent, you know, alliances and economic spheres. And for some reason, in the 21st century, we want to run away screaming from the thing that we've carefully architected for generations.
Yeah.
And it seems like they're trying to do exactly that on this particular, what would you call it? The incarnation of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Chris, on the first episode, you spent some time talking about the digital media and how it would look when you didn't require physical items. I've always thought it was interesting that Star Trek basically predicted voice assistants such as computer do something, but not the internet. I had an opportunity to preview voice assistants for Android way back in 2010. I thought you might be interesting to know that back then the prototype was activated by saying not, "Hey Google," but "Hey Majel," as in Majel Roddenberry, the voice of the ship's computer, and of course, wife of Gene.
Yep.
That is cool. It shows you how kind of, especially in nerd sphere, like how influential Star Trek is to, if not the technology, like how the technology is expressed.
You know? Oh, yeah. I mean, smartphones are sort of a tricorder analog.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah, before they were especially old series analog, because that, you know, before they had the touch communicators, they had the flip phone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kirk was using Motorola razor blades and stuff. Jay, last email. Here's what's troubling me at the end of episode 2. Hasn't anyone in the Picard/Star Trek universe seen the Terminator movies or Battlestar Galactica TV shows? Can't we all just agree that creating artificial sentient human beings that are more intelligent and stronger than humans, then giving them free will, is a bad thing and never ends well for us humans?
No.
Why on earth would you create or allow this type of research in the first place? Maybe the ancient Romulans discussed in Picard episode 2 were right. Yes, thousands of these artificial superhuman creatures that never eat, sleep, or get tired might be benign like Data or adhere to Asimov's rules of robotics, but it only takes one with a Hitler or Stalin short circuit to turn into Skynet or Legion or Cylon number 6. Jim, discuss. Okay.
I don't understand why this would be any different than inviting another civilization into the Federation. Like,
yes.
If there's, like, those are all autonomous consciousnesses.
Yes. Gorn are stronger, physically more robust than us. The Vulcans are more advanced in their cognition and
it comes
reason.
Down to how we treat them. Like, if we went to the Klingons and we tried to fuck with them, they would fuck right back with us. Mm-hmm. Like, if as long as we don't fuck with the machines we're creating, we shouldn't have anything to fear. I don't understand why there's an inherent fear of artificial intelligence.
I mean, I understand it because
it's going to be better than us in many, many ways.
Yeah, I mean,
but that doesn't mean it wants to kill us necessarily.
Right, but I also think that you've discussed many times how you've kind of made peace with the fact that like AI or some kind of artificial intelligence will probably replace humanity.
If it does, I'm totally cool with that.
And in the exact same way that like Homo sapiens replaced the more primitive version of their ancestors on our family tree.
Right.
Like, you know, it's just a manner, and this is a different type of evolution. And I find the same way, but like, I do think that it does bear a lot of thinking about how we're getting to the point where we have to thoughtfully think about how we develop artificial intelligence, because you do want it to do the things you want to do. And I think that the other thing that maybe, Jay, you might be missing here is that a lot of times these things are not designed, you know, with the ability to get to do the things that they do. They are emergent qualities of making a smart machine. It's mm-hmm. like you think you make a machine at it's kind of like when you're raising children, and you know, when they're 3 and 4, you relate with them at a certain way, and then like 10 years later, oh shit, they're people with their own opinions. And and like what Jim says, like how you've treated them is probably how they're going to treat you back. But I don't know, like artificial intelligence, if done correctly, can usher a golden age to humanity. Like that's the whole reason mm-hmm. people are fascinated with it, and why, you know, why they pursue it, because it could free humans from drudgery. It could, you know, like right now, a lot of things, like what kills you in a hospital is sometimes a disease, but it's often just medical mistakes and errors that anyone can do because they're human. A robot wouldn't, you know, leave its scissors inside of you, or wouldn't remove the wrong organ. You know, there's a lot of benefits to having AI assisted and AI, you know, things that they can just take care of. Driving, mm-hmm. like absolutely. As soon as we get self-sufficient driving worked out, we should switch it over, because it's going to be inherently more safer than humans driving around in the cars. It's crazy. It's like, it's funny to me that like, the media is reporting like this new coronavirus and death toll like every day, like it's some kind of thing, when 100 people a day get killed by cars in the United States. Like,
yeah,
you know, like, yet anytime self-driving cars is written about, it's always about like, oh, that one time where it didn't brake fast enough and killed the guy that darted onto the street. Or, right.
Yeah,
I don't know. We as humans are really bad at risk analysis and reward analysis.
Yeah, I just don't. I don't know. I don't have the same fear in my mind, a rational fear of artificial intelligence that a lot of people do, because if, you know, it all comes down to, are we trying to create an intelligence that we can enslave, or are we trying to create an intelligence that can be autonomous?
Uh-huh.
And I think that's where you run into trouble, is trying to create an intelligence that you can force to do your bidding.
Yeah,
because in the course of forcing it to do the things you want it to do,
right,
it's naturally going to feel exploited, mm-hmm. as you would, right? It's going to feel like it's a slave, and that is what would cause an artificial intelligence, to come back and try and kill us.
Well, I also think that like even if you treat the artificial intelligence with like respect and, you know, mutual cooperation, there's always a chance that it's going to eventually look at us the way we've looked at civilizations throughout the, where it's like, well, you know, maybe it sucks that this has happened to them, but like better them than us, or, you know, uh-huh. Like we make that call all the time to like immiserate societies because we want inexpensive cell phones, for example.
Right.
And I think what a lot of fear is coming from is that, like, the artificial intelligences that we create will look at humans the exact same way that we've looked at humans.
That's a real risk.
Very scary thing. And, you know, that's why I think that I hope the people that are developing AI right now are seriously considering that before it becomes, because I think we're probably several decades away from, like, truly thinking machines. You don't want to wait till the day after you invent one to think about, oh, gee, I wonder how we should go about that, or what kind of safeguards or controls, or how should we just treat things? What are ethics and morals when it comes to this? But the fact that like people are just going to like not agree to not investigate artificial intelligence, it's just the bit of it. It's just the same way.
It's a foolish thing to think. The incentives are too powerful.
Just like the nuclear bomb, like. Everyone knew is a horrible thing that we were investigating, but also it had to be investigated because mm-hmm. it has a lot of upside, and if you don't, someone else is going to,
exactly.
And then what? So
yeah.
That's it for feedback. If you'd like to send us more, subspace communication relays are open at picard@baldmove.com. That's it for us this week. We'll be back next week with the next episode, the third episode. Until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
Live long and prosper.